Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 12, Interview with Lance Mackey. Hi, this is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that transforms, trains, and transports you on the sport of dog sledding.
Transforms, trains, and transports.
You want to give it a shot, or do you need me to completely explain it to you?
It's Lance Mackey. I'm trying to think of the two races.
Whose life has been completely transformed in this last year?
Oh, well, that was good.
Lance Mackey, who's done, obviously, a lot of training to win both the Quest and the Iditarod in 2007.
Yes, at least 10 years plus.
And now I'm just going to let you guess this one. What about transport?
Ah, you got the truck.
Right. Lance is all about the truck, and he's going for Iditarod number two for him because of the truck.
Well, more than that,
for
but that's
sure.
A nice bonus.
But his
it.
Motivating factor is a truck.
Yes, I think it's great. Hey, we've got a really, really awesome interview today. We caught up with Lance. Talk about a busy guy. He is running. I think he was coming out of a TV commercial interview or something that we were able to hook up to him while he was traveling. And yes, of course, I had to ask him how his truck was running. And he said his wife was really enjoying it. So I thought that was great. And he tells a little bit about that. So I think you'll really appreciate that.
We decided to keep the beginning of the interview, which generally we don't. But so it's kind of the beginning.
Yeah. So it was off the cuff. He was traveling. He was in his vehicle traveling. So we thought we'd catch up to him. Good guy. You know, it's so neat to hear more than just a quick soundbite or a quick little bit from the wonderful mushers and the folks that are part of the Iditarod. You know, when we watch the 5-minute piece on, you know, Outdoor Network or on Cabela's or on any of the wonderful places that host it, we don't really get to know these folks. And after spending about 35, 40 minutes with Lance, you get to know him a little bit more, and you get to see the side of him that maybe you don't always get to hear. So it's great. We really hope you enjoy this.
Yeah, and I think it's neat. It's, you know, this was a historical event in the world of sports, the fact that someone won the Quest and the Iditarod, you know, back-to-back like that. So this has really never happened to any other person. What I liked was the way that Lance is treating his success. I mean, he's going after everything he can to promote the sport, of course, promote himself, which I thought was cool that he admits that, and thirdly, promote the state of Alaska.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a busy guy, and this has never happened before, and he's a runner, that's for sure.
I've heard that expression so many times, that the rising tide lifts all boats, and I think that's what Lance looks at. He thinks that, or what the impression that he gave us at least, was that the more folks that he can get to know about the Iditarod, about mushing, about the whole sport, and especially about Alaska, it'll be better for everybody. And I think he realizes that we can get more funding for the race, we can get different things, better, you know, more volunteers, all kinds of wonderful things, and I think he saw that. So he's really pushing hard for not just himself, but for the whole state and for everybody that's running in the races. So I thought that was really neat.
Yeah, I appreciated that for sure. You know, we never know what the personality is going to come out on these interviews, and thankfully, so far, the people that we've chosen to interview and people that have chosen to be interviewed have all been a joy to get to know, and that certainly was true with Lance as well.
Yes, and everybody's got a story, and I think maybe that's what we should have named this instead of the Sled Dog Podcast would be the Sled Dog Stories, because it's everybody has got a unique story of their life, of how they've got to where they're at, and Lance shares that with us, and so it was a glimpse of his past, a glimpse of what's made him who he is, and probably what's made a lot of the mushers that we know and maybe you know of who these people are. So as you listen to what Lance is talking about, try to put yourself into either his position or at least understand some of the people around us to understand and think, why are they doing what they're doing? And that meant a lot to me. So I really want to say thank you, Lance, for this interview. And also, you're not going to believe the last 5 minutes. The last 5 minutes, yeah. You are going to
Doesn't really have a whole lot to do with dog sledding, but
no, but I think it's
exciting.
Great. I don't know if we'll put it in the show notes or not, so we'll just surprise everybody. You're not going to believe it. You're just not going to believe it. Unless, of course, the news carried it up there in Alaska or something. I never saw this, I think it's just wonderful.
Right, it might be. But let's just jump to our mail, and what I love about this is what we need to do, and that is talk to all the people out there that belong to clubs, mushing clubs, that have newsletters. We would love for you just to put a little blurb about www.sleddogpodcast.com in your newsletter. That would be great. And what I did was try to get as many as I could find, and we got a response back from a Sharon Carpenter with the Cascade Sled Dog Club.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you. And she liked our podcast and website and things like that. So we say hello, Sharon, and glad you're listening. So anybody else out there that has a newsletter or a club or in any way that you can share the Sled Dog Podcast with your club or newsletter, we would so appreciate it.
And we also want to say we added something new on the website. About half of you out of the thousands that listen, well, okay, it's not thousands, but out of the half of you listen right off the webpage and the other half listen in iTunes. If you do want to use iTunes, if you've got iTunes installed, you can just click on our webpage in the upper left-hand corner. You can click on the iTunes link. Or below that, for those that have just listened on the computer, there's a little box. And actually, if you want to drop your email in there, the system automatically sends you an email letting you know when the new episodes are out. So we're relatively regular. Once a week, we try to get a story of Shoney out or an episode out. But sometimes it's 9 days, sometimes it's 5 days, so it's all over the place. But if you want an email, automatic email that just comes out once, it's not a spamming, nobody gets your address except for the system, and it just will let you know that there's a new episode out. So that's the big thing. Click on the iTunes link or on that email. Thank you for putting our podcast or description or just a link somewhere on your webpage or in your newsletter for your mushing groups. We would just love to get more and more visitors. And of course, you know, once we create this content, it's so nice to get it out there. And just to help us pay for it, I so want to say thank you to all the folks that are using the Amazon link on the page. We have, we've almost paid for half website stuff. You know, it's not a lot. You know, it's, I think we've made $44 or something now out of the hundreds we've spent. But it's definitely
okay.
Appreciated.
Thank you. That's cool. And it's just a way to do things easily. We
doesn't
appreciate
cost anybody
it. Keep
any
doing it.
Money
keep doing and, it.
Exactly. So we thank you so much for putting our link on your webpage. So if a lot of you got blogs, a lot of folks have different webpages, and they're putting our address, just www.sleddogpodcast, on the webpage. So we want to say thank you so much for that also.
All right. Well, don't forget, there's a Dr. Tim after this. We got a great new Dr. Tim up.
Yep.
And that's about it. Let's get to Lance, because I'm sure they want to hear that last 5 minutes.
It's going to be great. Just be surprised and send us an email if you just were laughing off your seat or excited. I don't know how anybody's going to take it other than we were just laughing and having a great time with
My
Lance.
My mouth dropped to the floor.
Yeah, I did. Wait till you hear this.
But I'm pretty sheltered, so.
Yeah, exactly. So way to go, Lance. Thank you so much.
I just got in my truck, so I'm good. If you can do this in the truck.
Yeah. Well, is this the new truck?
Oh no, my wife confiscated that one the minute I got it.
Smart
girl. Good girl.
Yeah. No, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say she confiscated it. I was more than willing to hand the keys over to her for two reasons. She earned it and deserved it just as much as I did. She's been here since day one. And it keeps me focused and determined to go do it again so I can have a new truck.
There you go.
I know. How many trucks can you win? Is there a limit on that? Or?
Nope.
Oh, no. You can win as many. You know, if I win 10 years in a row, I'd have 10 trucks. But, you just got to pay the taxes on them, you know?
Exactly. But you'll settle for that, right?
I'm willing to work with that, yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely. So, no, I'm still driving around the old truck. It's actually the truck that I drive right now is the truck that Martin Boozer won in 1997.
Nice. How'd you get a hold of that one?
Well, when he won it, he's sponsored by Knife Ford, so he couldn't have a Dodge. So he had to sell the Dodge, and he sold it to a family by the name of Mark and Debbie Modero. And last year, I've been pretty known for my truck issues, and I was desperately needing a new truck. This truck is hardly new, but the Moderos donated it the end of last year. So I got a new-to-me truck. It's hardly new. It's got 285,000 miles on it, so it's hardly new.
Holy cow.
Yeah, but it's kind of neat in the driveway. I got the 97 and the 2007 truck. So
There you go.
Well, let's hope it's not 2017 before you get the next one, right?
Oh, good God, no. I'll be retired before that.
I hear you. I hear you. Well, Lance, one of the questions that we really wanted to ask you, and this is just kind of a bizarre question, is, you know, everybody asks about the races and how long you've been doing this, and that's all out there, but tell us a little bit about you as the competitor. Did you grow up, obviously the family's been in dog sledding, but have you always been as competitive as you are now, or is it something that you kind of learn, or is it more of just that internal drive that you were born with?
We'll start here at the beginning. No, I grew up in this sport watching Dad and my oldest brother, Rick. You know, they became successful. They always had the main dogs. And me and my little brother, we always had, not only did we have most of the chores, but we had all the leftovers that really wouldn't make the cut. And that's what we had to deal with. And, you know, we had to deal with them on our own, basically. I mean, Dad would give us tips and pointers and stuff, but he wasn't out there with us. So, to be quite honest with you, it was pretty frustrating a lot of times because we didn't have a good leader and we had the leftover sleds and really no guidance, you know. So, we made do. We had fun with what we had, but, you know, any race that we went to, we was never in contention to win. We was just there because it was, you know, part of the family thing to do, so to speak. And we didn't take it real serious, you know. And then folks split up when we was just young. I was maybe 10 or 11. And, you know, by that stage, we'd already been doing all the chores, running the leftover dogs. Now my parents split up, and my dad took all the good dogs, left a couple, you know, and left basically my mom to support me and my brother in this sport. And it was tough. So we weren't real enthused about it, to tell you the truth. I mean, we had the dogs because they were, so to speak, left to us. I don't think at that particular time it's something that we would have chose to do.
Right.
But then when me and my brother both raced Junior Iditarod for 4 years that we were allowed up until 18. And, you know, I turned 18. I had, I don't remember exactly, but close to 100 dogs, no job, and really no future. And it was a no-brainer at that particular time to get rid of the dogs. I sold all the dogs and didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, so to speak. But I ended up going out to Dutch River and Kodiak, places like that, commercial fishing. Because as a little boy growing up, the people that were surrounded in my family that were successful were commercial fishermen. Right. They would go work for the summer, make a lot of money, and I'm just throwing numbers out there, but $100,000 in 3 months fishing, that was a lot of money to a 10-year-old. So my ideal life growing up would have been, you know, commercial fishing in the summer and racing dogs in the winter. But at 18, those really weren't priorities. You know, I knew I was fishing, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And the commitment of the dogs and all that was just, it wasn't feasible at that time. So, you know, I spent 10 or 11 years, 12 years fishing, and, you know, working with different people around the world, from, you know, the Philippines to right here in Alaska. And, you know, anytime that there was a conversation that I was, like, involved with, I always seemed to talk about dogs and racing dogs and my dad and the Iditarod and stuff like that. So, you know, I guess somewhere in my head it had been embedded that dogs were going to be a part of my life. I just didn't know it at the time.
Oh, exactly.
And so, you know, and I wasn't disappointed with that. I knew that I needed to change a lot of things and lifestyle and stuff if I was going to be if I was going to have a dog team, so to speak. So it wasn't on the priorities or the high on the to-do list, you know. But I did always have it in the back of my head that one day I wanted to run the Iditarod, and I wasn't even thinking of winning the Iditarod. I thought maybe as a dream, you know, one day that'd be cool. But I wanted to just run the Iditarod one time just to say I did it. You know, my dad did it, my brothers, my whole family is involved. But, you know, I seen money going out the door and the time and all that that my dad and my brother put into it. And, yeah, I was married and had a newborn baby and just didn't know if that still was what what I was going to spend my life doing. But
so what clicked? What happened?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. My first wife, you know, it didn't work out. I ended up losing my wife because of I spent too much time fishing. And after a short time, I met another lady that I was going to get married to, and I vowed right then and there that I wasn't going to lose her to fishing. We lived in Wasilla here in the state, and being a commercial fisherman, you know, I just couldn't give that up. So what happened was I uprooted my wife, or my future wife, and her two girls. And we moved down to the Kenai Peninsula, where we could fish in the summertime as a family, and that was where we started. Well, when I moved to Kenai, I bought a house right next to Tim Osmar, who is also an Iditarod musher, and his dad's, you know, won the Iditarod in 84 and stuff like that. So I moved in to next to Timmy with an old black lab, and within a year, I had 10 dogs. And they were 10 dogs that he didn't want. And it was as simple as I got those 10 dogs to teach the kids a little responsibility, what chores were like, and to kind of cure the little craving that I still had for dogs, you know. And we just played with them that winter. We were just starting out as a family, struggling financially, no intentions at all of really pursuing racing or nothing. We just wanted to tinker with them a little bit. And, you know, and that was in the winter of 1999. And in 2001, I ended up running the Iditarod for the first time, basically in the same kind of surroundings as growing up. I had a bunch of leftover dogs that nobody else wanted, with a bunch of beat up gear and truck, and just the desire to go run the Iditarod and finish and get a belt buckle in the patch that they give you when you finish. But by doing so and taking all the leftover dogs that nobody else wanted, I did fairly well. And I thought, and I told my wife, I said, you know, this is a good indication that if I was to put a little time and effort into this, we might be able to make something of it, you know. But we need to commit to it. And my wife was a little hesitant at the time, not knowing anything really about dog racing and the cost or the time. You know, she agreed to it, but I was realistic about it. And I told her, you know, and being fair to her and the family, basically, that I wasn't going to spend the next 20 years just running at the middle of the pack. I will devote 5 years and focus and, you know, all or nothing, so to speak. And at the end of 5 years, if we're not at least on the track of being competitive, then we'll try something different. And the reason I say being competitive, and I'm really not all that competitive, but I turned into a competitive person in this sport because I don't have a bunch of corporate sponsors. I don't have the financial backing that it takes to basically be competitive in this sport. If I'm not doing well, I'm like this year. If I don't do well this year, I won't be able to afford to do it next year. And that's as simple as it gets. I'm forced, basically, to do well. If I want to continue to do this, because the expense comes out of my pocket and the money that I make racing. So I'm not very serious and whatnot about too much in my life until I get on the runners of my sled. And then I'm full focused, 100%. I'm not out there to make friends, so to speak. They're my competitors, and I'm social, and I do have friends that I race against, but I'm out there to beat them as badly as possible so I can do this again next year.
Now, are the other races that you run throughout the year, are those to get you to the big race, or do you look at those as an income source also?
A little bit of both, to tell you the truth. You know, and I do quite a few preseason races, January mostly, and I've backed off a little bit, or I'm going to back off a little bit this year due to the fact I have an older group of dogs with plenty of experience that they don't need that. And the financial part of it, I've managed to save a little money from last year, so I'm not completely broke. But, yeah, generally in the past, I've needed to go to those preseason races to make a paycheck to be able to afford to go to the Quest or the Iditarod or the next race. And generally the pattern is I'll start in December at the Sheep Mountain 150, and I've been lucky enough 2 out of 3 years to win it. So I make a couple grand there that gets me to the next race, and I make a couple grand there that gets me to the next race. And that's kind of been the pattern for the last 3 years. And fortunately, this past year was the best year anybody's ever had, so I'm not so pressured this year to go do all those preseason races, you know, and hope to make a paycheck, so to speak. I'm concentrating this year on the quality of runs and the caliber that we come out, as opposed to the number of runs and number of races we do, hoping to make a couple grand, you know. It's not about the money this year. It's all about the experience on the young dogs. And I've set myself up for a kind of a certain level of expectations, not just from me, but from the state, if nothing else, and some of my competitors, you know. But I'm not going to be disappointed if I don't maintain a certain level either. I think I've accomplished the goals that I set out to do, and nobody's driving me any harder than myself. But like I said, I think I kind of set a bar, so to speak, of the level that I want to maintain now. So I'm training harder than ever, and I'm more focused than I've ever been, for the simple fact that I know I can do it again. I have the determination and the drive. So I'm looking forward to another great year.
So let's just kind of jump back just a sec to clarify part of it. So when you get on a sled, you have a different competitive drive than you do, say, when you're fishing or in any other sport. I don't know any other sports that you undertake or you have time to undertake. So is there a different competitive drive that comes upon you in dog mushing?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, nothing against my competitors, but I'm, like I said, in a nice way, I'm not there to make friends with anybody. I'm out to, you know, I'm going to do the best I can. But yeah, I'm out to get them, so to speak. I'm gunning for any one person in particular. But yeah, when I step on my sled runners, I am kind of a whole different person. I don't joke around too much. I don't talk really too much. I do to the media, but as far as my competitors, I'm like I said, I'm out to get them. I'm racing, and yeah, I'm full focused on what I'm doing when I'm on my runners.
And when you're fishing, is there any competition in that with you?
Well, there is, because it's just came about in the last few years, my competitive drive, and I want to be the best I can be at what I'm doing, and it doesn't matter what I'm doing. But I feel because my two careers are fishing and dog racing, you know, I'm a small guy, and I've always been kind of underestimated in my size and my motivation or whatever. So, yeah, I'm always trying to better the guy that's supposed to be the best, you know. And I thrive on the underestimation part. Because people see my size, and I'm fishing against people that are twice my size with twice the experience, you know, and they don't think that I'm going to make it, so to speak. So, yeah, I'm out to prove to like that I'm as good as they are or better. So absolutely, yeah. My competitive drive has really blossomed in the last few years, for sure.
Now, do you like that feeling to know that people look, you know, they kind of think that you know the smaller guy and that kind of stuff? Do you like that underdog kind of approach?
I do. I think that for my own, I don't know, for my own satisfaction, so to speak, I don't want say the guys that I'm working next to ever questioning me doing my part of or my job, you know. Yeah. I don't want to ever have somebody have to take up my slack, you know. And because of my size, people do underestimate me, and that just gives me more just drive to prove to them that, you know, people like myself, and not just me, there's a lot of people like me that are capable of doing the jobs at hand, you know. And most people my size have now got the reputation to, we kind of are the better fishermen. We last longer. We don't burn out. We're not too big to where we can't maneuver, you know. So all those things that are, like, uncharacteristic of people, I'm starting to become, like, the stereotype, you know. And people that are, I think that's pretty cool, because I'm not the normal person you'd see on a crab boat. Normally, people size, maybe not as, you know, not as fast. I think my size, I benefit because I'm maneuverable. I can, you know, go the same speed all day long as opposed to in spurts. So, yeah, I think it's a pretty neat feeling, so to speak, to be looked at as a kind of the role model in the traditional style of, you know, fisherman or whatever it is nowadays.
Lance, you know? is there a lot of physical prep to get ready for the Iditarod, or actually race season in general? I mean,
well, even the Yukon Quest. Yeah, which race is harder physically for you, the Yukon Quest or the Iditarod?
And do you have to prepare for those physically?
Well, there is a lot of prep, and in all honesty, the most of the prepping is just the daily activity with the, you know, the regular chores in the morning, and the, you know, the interaction with the dogs and hooking them up and actually being out on the trail. You don't need to get up every morning to go jogging. I get up every morning and I feed 70 dogs and clean the dogs and hook them up and all that. And that is enough exercise, so to speak. If you're out there on the runners for 10 hours a day, standing up on your feet 10 hours a day is a lot of work, even just standing there. But we're not standing there. You know, the hills, you get off and run in the hills, or, you know, I mean, there's things that you do on a regular basis that you don't need to exercise. You know,
so you don't need to go down to the gym for a Tylo class, huh?
No, absolutely not. And I am as rock solid and I'm in as good a shape now as I was when I was in high school, when I, you know, when I did work out and I had gym every day and, you know, stuff like that. I'm stronger, more alert, I'm just more physically fit than I am ever was. And it's because of the dogs. No doubt about it. It's just the interaction every single day with the dogs. You lift them in and out of the dog box. You know, they're 50 pounds a piece, and you do that 20 times, you feel it in your lower back, you know. So you don't need to go out and do a bunch of curls or squats or something with a dumbbell, you know. Dog food buckets are, you know, when they're full, they're 35, 40 pounds a piece, and we have 8 food buckets, you know, and you do that 2-3 times a day. So, you know, plenty of time lifting weights, and you're walking with those buckets, so you're getting exercise there. You know, the cardiovascular part of it, you're hooking the dogs up. And believe me, if you're, you know, at the end of a 16-dog string on dog number 16, you're gasping for air and you're sweating and you're running because the 15 other ones in line are impatient, standing there barking to go.
Oh, exactly. And, that's a good motivation, isn't it?
You're running, you know. You're not just walking, walking and at a leisurely pace, you know. You're running, so... yeah, as far as that goes, there's no extra time to go work out or run or nothing. You don't need to. And the people that do are doing it for own satisfaction because it's not necessary at all.
Lance, do you think that this year, because that you don't have that, I guess that desire, I mean, last year was just a perfect year with the 13 and everything else that came about. Do you think this year will be that same drive that you have, or do you think you're going to, I don't want to say softer, but you think you have a different approach, more strategy than you do ambition, or is it just as strong of ambition this year?
Well, I think it's stronger this year for the simple fact now I know I can do it. My dog team's capable, and like I said before, I still need a new truck, you know? And those are the things that keep me getting out of bed every morning. And I love what I do. So, yeah, my drive and my devotion to this sport is not diminished at all. I mean, like I said, I think it's more stronger than it ever was for the simple fact I'm confident in the fact that we have the capability. And the other thing I guess that is driving me is the simple fact that a lot of people think that it was a fluke or luck or whatever it might be, that I didn't really earn it or work for it. And I hear these little comments, you know, rumors, so to speak, from my competitors. Not once has anybody ever came up to me and told me, boy, you can't do that again. But you hear those things along the way. And I really, honestly, I don't care what people think, but I think if I had an opportunity to basically prove to them or whatnot that it wasn't luck, that, you know, I worked my butt off for it and I earned it and I think I deserved it. You know, like I said, irrelevant what all those people think, but I think if I have the opportunity to shut them up, so to speak, then I'm going to take advantage of it.
Yep, that's right.
Absolutely.
That's
yeah.
Right.
And, you know, yeah. And I don't know what that is, if it's a coping mechanism or something that they have to, you know, I think we all do that, but that's terrible that we do it, huh?
It is. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not out to get any one specific person. I'm not out to prove anything to anybody, but for my own satisfaction and my own drive, those are just some of the things that, like I said, keep me getting out of bed every morning. And I'm training harder this year than I ever have in the past. Because, I'm adding logs to an already burning fire, so to speak. And I'm just getting going. That's how I feel. I've accomplished a great deal of things in this sport, but I really feel that I'm just beginning. So those are things, like I said, you know, whether I come in first or 21st this year, it remains to be seen. But I'm damn sure going to go do my best and have fun doing it.
There you go.
And that to me is more important than where I finish.
No, and that's wonderful. And how does your family doing with all the excitement and the attention this year? Is it going well? Or do they look at Dad and go, oh boy, Dad's got another interview?
Well, that's kind of how the kids are responding. And my wife, to tell you the truth, is kind of getting irritated with it, I think, because, and especially this time of year, people on a regular basis, they want interviews, pictures. Her train of thought is, this is normal. She's seen what we've started with and what we became. And like she said, it would be abnormal for her now if I don't do good in a race or people aren't calling. So I think she's a little bit irritated with it, but I think she's excited about it. She just didn't know that all of this was going to come about, you know? And I guess I didn't either. To an extent I did, but I overwhelmed sometimes by the amount of people, you know, wanting pictures or interviews or what have you, because this is not normal, and it wasn't normal until this last year's success. And so we're still trying to adapt to it, you know? And I think it's, in my opinion, I think it's cool. I don't ever have to buy a lunch or, you know, people everywhere I go recognize me or want autographs, and I think that's just great. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to another year of similarity.
Now, Lance, you know, you're dad won it, your brother won it. Do you see the frenzy or the media and so forth? Is it a lot different compared to the last two times that you saw people win close to your family?
Oh, absolutely. And that just goes with the territory as far as the, you know, 1978, when my dad won outside the state of Alaska, no one knew what the Iditarod was. And people inside the state were still trying to figure out what the Iditarod was. 83, a little more publicity, a little more, you know, outside state. People were starting to learn a little more about it. This year, for example, I have people following me from Jamaica and from Australia and from Europe and just different places around the world. That in itself is a huge, huge change. You know, 78 to 2008, people didn't know nothing about it. Like I said, in the state, now they're all over the world, they know about it via the internet or what it is. So, yeah, it's came a long, long way. And I think it still has a long way to go. You know, and because of what I accomplished this year, means, you know, nobody had ever won the Quest and the Iditarod in the same year. Not only are we getting more publicity for our sport and myself, it's bringing the race like Yukon Quest, basically, more people are finding out about it. You know,
it's bringing it to the forefront. Absolutely. Yeah.
It is. And they're, you know, at one time and not too long ago, it was almost, I don't know how to word this the right way, but the Iditarod and the Quest were kind of bashing each other. They want to be involved with each other, so to speak. They were two separate races based around two separate theories, different people. Now, I'm kind of bringing those two races together.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's beat on the Iditarod or beat on the Quest, so to speak. It's like, well, we can get along. We can be a part of each other without it interfering with each other, so to speak.
Yeah, that old saying, a rising tide lifts all boats, you know, and you're right.
Yeah, you know, and I think, I'm pretty proud of the fact that I was at least contribution to that. And it's good for our sport. It's good for the publicity for myself. In general, like I said, for the sport, I think it's wonderful.
Well, and you know, I think about it, you're 35, right? So you've got another, 25 or 30 years to run the Iditarod. What are your plans?
My plans are definitely not to be running the Iditarod 30 more years.
No.
I mean, I would love to think, okay, well, let me start at the beginning. You know, for people that know, I had some cancer issues not too long ago. And because of it, I had some side effects, and mostly in my hands. My hands are just not holding up. And, you know, and that's kind of some of the drive that I have as well. I know that my body isn't going to hold up the way my mind wants it to, so to speak. And, you know, if I can get, realistically, if I can get 5 more good years of race, that'd be a good career. But I'd like to, my vision is basically to be a kennel owner, the manager, whatever, the boss, and have people working for me that want to race the Iditarod, that want to become successful. And I think I could not only provide them with some knowledge, but the dogs to be able to do that. And it would supplement some income, you know, people lease teams like that. So basically, I would like to start a school or whatever you want to call it. I want to be involved in the sport. I don't see myself on the runners all that much.
There you go. So, well, you know, and speaking of that, you know, there's two things I'd like you to comment on. One is, any cancer victims that may be listening to this, and I don't know how many there are out there, and especially with, you know, everything that's going on in the world today, is there any advice that you would give them to say, you know, to get back on the runners kind of thing?
Well, yeah, you know, for myself, the dogs were my focus and my, I don't know, it might sound corny, my reason to get out of bed every morning. And I'm not taking nothing away from my family. They were every bit as inspirational for me to live. But in all honesty, my family could take care of themselves without me. My dogs can't. And that was something that I had to focus on. That was one of the reasons that I, like I said, got out of bed every morning. They were dependent of me. You just, for somebody with the cancer, they have to have something basically to focus on that they do look forward out of bed for every morning, because cancer is a very, very emotional roller coaster ride. You know, I was fortunate enough to pull through a very serious situation. They didn't think that I was going to. And that alone was enough determination for me, basically, because they said I wouldn't live. I wanted to prove to them that I could, that I was going to live, because I have a lot of things that I still want to do. And I think for most people with cancer, they don't have a whole lot of, I mean, other than family, there is not a whole lot of things to drive them to want to get out of bed. You know, there's a lot of people that have a job that they probably could care less if they got up and went and did tomorrow. You know, I'm not that person. I have a job that I love and I look forward to doing every day. So for me, it was real simple. I had the dogs, I had my family, and I had the doubters that didn't think I was going to pull through. Those are the things we pull through, you know. So in my opinion, you have to focus on something and have a reason to live, you know, because it is real easy. And I've seen it firsthand. It'd be real easy to just curl up in a little ball and say, never mind, you know, this ain't worth the fight. That's the easy way out.
So was then Iditarod 2004 almost probably extra special versus even 2005 and 2006?
Well, 2004 was special in a lot of ways because, for 2003, I didn't make it to Nome after the attempt, literally right out of the hospital. And I was focused on doing the Iditarod when they said I couldn't do it for my own motivation, my own drive and all that. 2004, yeah, it was pretty emotional for me because, for one, I had my little brother Jason ran the Iditarod for the first time, and we traveled together the whole way. So that was pretty special to me. But for the simple fact that I made it to the finish line,
right?
You know, that alone was enough drive, basically, to pursue my career in this sport. You know, I did it. I did it when people said I couldn't do it. I wasn't going to live, you know. I wasn't going to race dogs again. Now I've made it to the finish line, and I was very upbeat and happy, and I had a good run, and I mean, everything went fairly smooth. Also, yeah, that was pretty rewarding. But had I ever never won a race or the quest, you know, I don't think that I'd be any different than I am today. I think it's just kind of an added bonus that I happened to win them. And of course, like I said, I'm going to do my best no matter what I do, and winning is not my ultimate goal. Sure is a nice bonus.
So, Lance, with having your little brother obviously run with you, and there's so many children that listen to this, our podcast, and there's so many people that are getting into the sport, what kind of encouragement or advice would you give them to say, you know, if they're going to be competitive or at least just doing it for fun and family, what would you say to them to say, you know, to go do it?
Yeah, well, I guess the competitive part is second to all the, you know, the priorities. Priority number one is just have fun doing what you're doing. And for somebody that's getting into this sport, seriously think about the commitment that you're making, and not just the time, the financial commitment as well. You will sacrifice, you know, Friday nights at the movies, and you'll seem to not have time for anything, especially if you get into this to be competitive. I don't think that that's the right step for most people. I think they need to learn the ropes and the basics, so to speak, and that being take the best care of your dogs as possible, because they ultimately, the better you take care of your dogs, your finishing possessions will improve. And patience. If you're not a patient person, this is not the sport for you. it comes hand in hand. You're going to be broke. You're going to need to be patient. And I shouldn't say you're going to be broke. 90% of the mushers in this sport don't have an extra dollar to spend, because we are trying to better, you know, our gear or our personal gear or our dog food. You know, anybody can run dogs. You don't have to have a qualification. You don't have to try out for the team. Anybody can do it. But that's one of the setbacks in this sport is there are no qualifications. And just because you want to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, you know, you get in real easy, but it's hard to get out. And one dog turns to 30 in a hurry, you know, and it's a huge commitment. So yeah, for anybody getting into it, just think about it and go, if you can, run somebody else's dogs and help with their kennel for a while before you try to establish your own, because a lot of people do it fine, and they're great and gung-ho for a year, maybe two, even 5 years. And then they realize that, you know, they haven't been on a family vacation, and their truck's just about to die, and they can't afford to fix it. And, I mean, you know, the house has been mortgaged 3 times so that they can run the Iditarod. Things like that are a daily story on any of these mushers you talk to. And it's... And it's not about the money or the publicity. It is flat out, it is the love of the sport and the love of the animals and the lifestyle. It's not for everybody. So, you know, think about it.
Oh, absolutely. Think about it. Well, this year has been absolutely wild for you. All the places you've got to go and that kind of stuff. And I read one article. How is your golf game coming along?
Well, let's just say I've had better luck on the runners than I did on the green.
I had a feeling.
I won't be trading in the sled for a set of golf clubs anytime soon. But I find myself out there having a good time. And you know, like I said, I don't know that I'll become a professional golfer, but I'm damn sure going to put in some more time. I had a great time doing it, and it's just fun. It was a good time.
So any do you do predictions, anything for this coming race season about what's going to be happening?
Well, I would think that, you know, sitting here at the moment, my team looks as good or better than they ever have, you know, and I'm realistic. I think I have a shot at repeating last year's performance, and those are some of my goals, is improving on some of my performances over last year. Now we had great race results, but there was some things to improve on, personal performance and whatnot. So if I can improve on last year's performance and keep the same finishing positions, I'd be a happy man.
That's wonderful.
So you're basically going to use most of the same dogs?
Well, we have all but one from last year in contention still, but we have a lot of younger coming dogs that are, you know, in my opinion, they're as good or better than what we've drove in the past. They just are lacking a little bit of experience. I'm a little bit optimistic, but I'm also thinking back to 2005 and the fact that I had a two-year-old dog team when I won the Yukon Quest. So I know that young dogs are what they're capable of. It's just a matter of how everything falls into place. So I'm realistic, but I'm optimistic as well. And I think I have, like I said, I think I have as good a shot as anybody in any race that we enter. So, again, I'm just looking to do it again, have fun doing it, and see how the cards fall into place, so to speak.
So are any of the Mackey children of yours future Iditarod runners?
Well, I have a stepson, Kane, that's been helping me for the last 2 years. And yeah, they didn't grow up doing this sport like I did. So for me to see Kane coming into it like he is, he just turned 16. He ran two junior Iditarods. And for him to see my success has encouraged him a little more to want to be involved. So, like, he's now one of my main handlers. He runs daily, does daily chores, and because of it, he gets a good team this year to run the junior Iditarod as opposed to the leftovers, like, you know, tradition was. You know, I had leftovers when he started, and now he's earned the spot with a good team. So I heard him just the other day mention to somebody else that when he turns 18, he wants to, when on his sixth attempt, he wants to win the Iditarod as well. That was what it was.
Oh,
so
you.
To say the thoughts are there anyway, whether he pursues it, I don't know.
That's wonderful.
Is there any other passions or anything that you want to share or you want to talk about?
Well, yeah, you know, I guess one thing that I've had to work on a little bit here is supporting my wife and the things that she now wants to do. She's been with me, you know, we're going on 10 years, just over 10 years now, and she's been right there with every decision, good or bad, and she's stuck with me. Now it's my turn to start basically fulfilling some of her dreams, and this is a little bit odd for me, but I have to mention it, that there's a TV program called Wife Swap. And we are affiliated with that. And at the end of March, after 6-7, we will be doing that TV commercial, Wife Swap. My wife will be somewhere in Lower 48 being catered to and pampered. And I got to deal with some little rich girl that's never seen a dog.
We cannot wait. We saw that on a couple of different, Sled Dog Central or some other things. I can't wait for that.
She wants to do this?
Well, somebody had requested her, turned her, however it came out, and when they approached her, this was something that, she was ecstatic over. She's always said that, you know, she'd like to be pampered and not have to get up every morning and feed the puppies, and she would love to see somebody, you know, and we're just using Dallas, Texas, for example, some rich oil lady that's never had to wash dishes in her life or use an outhouse or nothing like that, to try to take her place, and damned if it isn't going to happen. So yeah, she's very excited about it. And to tell you the truth, I was not. I don't really want to have to deal with some little missy that, you know what I mean? I'm going to be nice, but I just don't want to have to deal with somebody like that because I don't know any, you know, my surroundings to me are normal. People that their surroundings are normal to them. And to be completely the opposite, it's going to be a little bit hard for me because I don't have patience in those categories, you know.
Is it for a week or how long is it for?
Yeah, it's like 2 weeks actually. It's a 2 week program. 1 week they live the way we live, and then she's allowed to change the rules, so to speak, for the last week. So, you know, like I said, I wasn't so enthused about this at first, but now because it's something my wife wants to do and she's very excited about it, I'm getting more into it. And I think now, and we talk about it on a daily basis, how this is going to kind of be fun and not for just myself and my family, but our state is going to get involved with this. And it's, you know, here's a good example. We haul our water, and down at the Fox Water Hole, they're going to have a camera crew sitting there for this lady to fill up these water jugs. And because there's a camera crew, people on the highway are going to stop. And it's going to be a huge publicity stunt, so to speak, for me and our state. It's going to be seen worldwide, you know. And I think for publicity of our sport alone, I'm willing to do this. Not to mention that my wife wants to do it. So I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone here. Yeah, I think it's going to be great. And I, like I said, I wasn't looking forward to it, but now I kind of am. So
wow.
So yeah,
she wants for you. Go, husband, go.
So let me get this straight. She wants to get rid of you for 2 weeks. And that's a good thing. Huh?
Well, if she had it her way, it'd probably be longer than that.
Oh, that is funny.
Wow.
Well, that is
so
great.
This is the new Lance.
Lance, now, did you ever think, though, that maybe it's the role reversal, that you're the nice household and that there's a rougher place someplace that she might have to go to?
Yeah.
She thought that could be the case. But the lady that we've been speaking to said that's probably unlikely.
Oh, good.
Well, good. Well, good for Tanya, then.
Yeah, great. And you know, that is a good thought. We might be the more fortunate ones. So we've thought about that as well. And either way, we're up for it. So,
well, God bless you.
It's going to be good. It'll be fun.
Well, great. Anything else you got a passion about or anything else you want to talk about?
Well, the one thing I always try to mention is my fans, my family, and fans' family, and my supporters, and not just mine, the supporters in general for this sport. You know, without them, we couldn't have a sport. So I really, really appreciate it, and you know, hopefully, we can keep it exciting for people to continue to follow us.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we thank you so much. We know you're really
my
busy,
pleasure.
And especially with your debut coming up.
Thank you so much. Drive careful and tell the family we said hello. Wow, what a great interview with Lance, huh, Jean?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot.
Can you believe that? Wife swap. That I mean, obviously.
No, thank you.
Yeah, Jean was like, I don't know.
You know, I unfortunately had this horrible thought at first, thinking this is the first thing that we're really going to have to edit out because I didn't know what he was going to say. I'm pretty sheltered. We don't really do TV. We just pretty much watch movies. We don't know much about the reality TV shows. And real quick, Tim kind of gave me a, it's okay, it's okay. And then as Lance explained it, I thought, oh.
Yeah, I think it's a great, well, I want to say great exposure, but you know, that's not really what I mean. But it's going to be a great opportunity for
the whole world to see us. Again, it just introduces the sport of mushing to the world.
Well, you know what? And what kind of reminds me is sometimes we see these movies of sled dog races like Iron Will and other movies that have been out. And you see the one racer who comes up from Alaska or he's the underdog and he's got nothing. And then, of course, you look over and you've got this guy that drives up in this big, huge, you know, $400,000 motorhome and he's got this big trailer and a bunch of people all working for him. You know what? That doesn't happen, you know, or it doesn't happen much. Where these people have just gobs of money into the sport. And I don't know if people from the lower 48 or around the world understand that dog sledding takes a lot. It's 24/7. You don't take vacations. You don't go places. You don't have stuff without having it impact your lives. And so everything is calculated. So I think Lance brings that out. And I think maybe the Wife Swap TV show would, you know, would yeah. definitely bring that out to show.
Show this
is what it's all about.
Falling water from
yeah.
the-
yeah. I think that'll be great.
Yeah, so. It'll be fun.
So wonderful. We hope you enjoyed that one. Let's jump on to Dr. Tim. Today, Dr. Tim's going to be talking about kennel options. You know, different ways that you can build your kennels. And how's your dog? Here we go. Hey, Dr. Tim, why don't you talk to us a little bit about kennel options?
Sure. There's different ways to set up a dog yard. I've seen many, many different ways across the continent and different countries for that matter. You see the most common one is with the chain and the post, you know, a 5-foot chain roughly, and the dog goes around in circles. And then a lot of people will use pens as well. I think there's pros and cons to both. Let's do the chains first. I think the chain advantages there allows for dogs to be communal, but they can't touch. That's a big plus. I think the largest plus with using a chain is that they learn how to jump over the chain as they will on a gang line. So with young dogs, when we put them on a chain, at first they're pretty pouty, but they get used to it. But they go through a lot of opportunity to learn about chain management is what I call it, and that's just like a tug line getting tugged underneath them with the chain, they're going to learn how to kind of get around that when it gets tangled around them to some degree. There's always the risk that we're going to get a bad tangle with the chain on a dog. That's pretty uncommon for that to happen. I think the benefits of them learning about a chain outweigh the dangers of using a chain. I think the main problem with chains when people use them is just how they fasten them to whatever the fix is to the post, meaning that if we don't use the correct type of fastening device from the chain to the rebar that might be welded to the chain or otherwise, the chain might not spin freely. So if you're starting to get a chain that's binding up on itself, something's wrong. Either we use the wrong kind of snap on it, the snap is locked due to sand, the type of attachment between the chain and the rebar isn't correct, it's just not moving smoothly, and that's where you're going to have a problem with anything. So we got to make sure that the dog doesn't start to cause it to bind up. People, a lot of times when the dog breaks a snap, will then just use the broken snap to snap it back to the chain. Again, that won't swivel correctly, and it'll bind up on itself, and it can lead to a disaster. So have some extra chains made up in whatever fashion it is so we don't get to those needing to use quick remedies that leads to disaster. But I think overall a chain setup is not a bad one. I think it's a very accepted one. And the dog gets a lot of exercise running around in a circle. The dog houses that we use in a chain setup, you just have to have it set so the dog can get around it and not get tangled up in the doghouse. I think that's just a matter of common sense on how you set up your doghouse chain deal. If we get into the pen deal, that way I think pens require a little bit more attention in that the dogs will chew the fence apart at times. They're off their chain, which is good, but often the pens are going to be put right next to the next dog so they can get access to the other dog's foot through the chain fence. So you have to be a little cautious about that deal, and I've seen some disasters happen there. In either case that you try, I think free running the dogs off the chain or out of the pen is really beneficial to them so they can get away from their normal confinement so they can stretch it out. So if you choose a chain or a pen setup, you know, let them get out and run around and let them do their natural kind of gait where they're just running loose, and that's going to benefit either situation. So I see a place for both of them. We use a chain setup in our kennel, and it's always worked well for us over the years. When we start to talk about dog houses, there's a lot of different ways to make a dog house. A dog house out of one piece of plywood is the most common thing. You see a lot of barrel use too. Problems that we'll run into with dog houses are, one, with the plywood, the dogs like to glue and they like to chew the dog houses up in little bits. They're part beaver, and that's just what dogs do. Number two is just proper drain management with the doghouse. Make sure it can dry out, meaning there's holes in the floor if it's a drum or if it's a freestanding doghouse. Make sure there's still some access for water to get out of there. And as to insulation with these doghouses, honestly, the only thing dogs need is a windbreak, which is going to be your four-sided shelter with a roof, and then straw. So if we do that, I think they're going to be adequately warm. They have got a good fur coat. They're outside all the time, so they acclimate to the weather. So if we're changing their straw regularly so it doesn't get frosted and frozen in their doghouse, they're going to stay very well warm without having to insulate the doghouses. Dogs like to chew insulation up, and I find that insulated doghouses usually lead to even more chewing, then the dogs eat the insulation and so on and so forth. So I think good fresh straw changed on a regular basis is probably more beneficial than anything in the walls of the doghouse. Anything else particularly that you're looking for?
Dr. Tim, in the wintertime, how much more dog food will a dog consume to keep warm usually?
Yeah, in the wintertime, dogs tend to go through about 20% more food just to keep themselves warm because of their own furnace. But what I'll see is early in the season, they tend to go through more food, and then it stabilizes out or actually drops later in December. And I think that's a level of acclimation to the weather conditions. So the dogs get used to it, their metabolism changes a little bit, but they'll definitely go through some more food. When we get into the big cold extremes, like you'll see up in Alaska or Northwest Territories or something where it's 20, 30, 40 below, then their metabolism starts to kick back up again. And often those folks need to go to 3 times a day feeding just to try to keep their weight on because they are trying to keep themselves so warm in that so bloody cold weather. So there's a lot different between weather like we're used to in Michigan, Wisconsin, where cold is 0 or 10 degrees, and 30 or 40 below like in Fairbanks. So here we can deal with food increases much more subtly than up in Fairbanks, where they're going to have to go to almost 3 times a day feeding just to keep those dogs' weight good because they're burning up so much energy to stay warm. A lot of people will use actually dog barns up in those situations where they do bring the dogs indoors to keep warm to help on the food bill and overall health of the dog. I think when you have a dog in extreme cold weather situations, all their energy is going towards staying warm versus their energy going to things like muscle fitness and just their overall immune system status. So that's why those dogs might get a little bit oh, more ill in certain situations than, let's say, a dog that's kept in a warmer climate. They also heal differently when it's really cold. They tend to heal slower when it's very cold. Again, that boils back to the energy being devoted towards staying warm versus healing.
Interesting. Good point. Thank you so much, Dr. Tim.
Oh, sure.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tim. That was wonderful again. And don't forget, everybody, to go out to his website if you get a chance. It's drtims.com. So go out and check out his website. And if you, you know, get a chance, pick up a bag of his dog food. It's good stuff.
It is.
It's meaty.
It's actually quite good.
It's quite good. Yes. And if you listen to the stories from Shoney, they talk about it a lot. So we'll talk about that, too. So, wonderful show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Don't forget to use the Amazon link if you can't get a chance. We would love some more feedback. So, Sharon, Jenny, Leslie, Matt Hammersley from the UK, everybody else, we just thank you so much for your feedback. Keep it coming. Don't forget to use the Amazon link. Put our link on your webpage if you get a chance. All the other wonderful ways you can promote us. Well, you know, it sounds kind of selfish, doesn't it? Promote us. I guess we just want more people to hear. If we're going to do the work, we would just love more people to hear us. So it's kind of fun. So we just thank you. The numbers are getting up there, and it's going well.
So more interviews to come.
More interviews to come. And if you know of anybody that wants to be interviewed, let us know. So until next time, thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
Be blessed, everyone.